So someone who recently attended a retreat wrote this letter to me, and I think it's a good example of, and there's a lot to talk about in it that can help us to understand our practice this morning and what I'm going to lead to into this afternoon. So, hi Steve. This past week at school, this person is a fifth grade school teacher. Okay? So, this past week at school really put a test to my practice of mindfulness. This is her trouble. Meaning, the topic this weekend, trouble ahead. Well, here it is. It arrived. This past week at school really put a test to my practice of mindfulness. I dealt with an extremely hostile parent who was both attacking and threatening me. Scary. The entire time, I tried so hard to be aware of my mind and what thoughts arose. In situations like this, I found it really difficult not to be reactive. I tried so hard to be strong, but I broke down in tears a few times. And of course, that made me feel like a failure. I kept saying to myself, "You just came back from an 8-day mindfulness retreat. You should be better than this. Why are you so weak?" I was mad at myself, but I knew that I was only human and that I was hurting. Reacting to one parent's really harsh and hateful words that deep down were due to more than my actions. I should send you the letter that was sent to me. It's a very sad one. I could barely read the entire thing. My body started shaking and reacting very negatively to the words. As I started feeling this, I knew I had to forward the email to my team of fifth grade teachers and the administration. I couldn't handle this on my own. What would you have advised me to do? I started investigating and asking myself lots of questions about how I was feeling, why I was reacting so aggressively to these words, the nature of all of this. In the end, it still made me sad, and I definitely took it personally because it was an attack on my human values. I'd love your advice and guidance on this. This year especially has been a very trying one for me in my teaching life. I've had the most challenges and the years almost coming to an end, but the problems have not ceased. I just thought I'd share this with you so I can get better at handling these difficult parent situations. That's the kind of trouble I'm trying to address with this practice and instruction this afternoon. You know, there's trouble. But the trouble is really in our heart, isn't it? There's troubles and there's conditions in the world that cause a lot of distress. But when we get something like this where it's deeply personal to us, it's not just out there politically or economically in the international scene, but it's face-to-face, you know, just caught in the reactivity of our own minds or in the reactivity of someone else's mind. So when I read this, I thought, wow, okay, here's someone who is, you know, trying to be aware in the situation, in a work situation. And when, you know, confronted with this hateful, hurtful, shaming, whatever else he said, threatening and attacking parent, all of her feelings of being scared and being, you know, belittled and being having, you know, strong reactions in her mind are normal. It's not like even practicing awareness that we should somehow not have normal reactions. If we're being not just praise and blame, not just being blamed, but being attacked for our behavior or our perceived behavior, then it is normal to have reactions of fear, anger, rage, feeling vulnerable, feeling, you know, shame, slandered, and whatever. I mean, so I think there's a little bit in her perception of, I wish I was strong enough not to have to feel these things. But that's not the direction that awareness goes. Awareness and wisdom doesn't take you to the place of not feeling normal human interactions. So, as she said, she says, I tried so hard to be aware of my mind and what thoughts arose. I found it really difficult not to be reactive. If she didn't emphasize what she was saying, I'd say, yeah, that's right. I found it really difficult not to be reactive. Because any of us would find it difficult not to be reactive. That's normal. You know, and as the Buddha pointed to, he said, you know, even the Buddha doesn't do things that are not normal. They're normal within the range of his stuff. So we're not trying to become abnormal. We're trying to be normal. We're trying to be fully aware of the normal human response, reactions to these kind of situations. Now, admittedly, we don't want to just act out everything we feel, everything that we are provoked to. And so she was saying that, I tried so hard to be strong. I'm not sure what she means about that, but it seems like if she was strong, she wouldn't react, wouldn't have any reaction, wouldn't cry, wouldn't go to seek help from allies, and that's not strong. That's not what strong means, really. To be strong means to have a mind and to be aware in your mind and be able to open to and be with these kind of experiences. When I was first practicing with Sayadaw U Pandita, who was a Burmese monk, a very demanding senior monk, and who just got you to practice in the most intense way. He recently passed away, about a year ago now. But when I was first working with him, it was the first time he came to America, and he heard my name was Steve Armstrong. So Armstrong, he really got a kick out of Armstrong. So I was I was doing a 3-month retreat with him, and I was reporting to him every day. And after he got my name in his language, every time I would come in, he'd say, And he's kind of a big guy, and he's just an immovable rock-like guy. He goes, mind strong. Is your mind strong today? I had no idea what the hell he was talking about. It's like, mind strong? I don't know what that means. You know, mind strong. Well, now I understand that when the mind is strong in the way he's using it, it's not like you're just strongly opinionated or really stiff-minded and, you know, really, you know, hanging on to something. It's more that your ability to be with and open to and acknowledge what arises in the mind is steady and strong. So that when faced with, in this situation, a very angry someone confronting you with a lot of anger and shaming, it's like, okay, can our mind open to that? Can it go, okay, this is what that feels, this is what's happening. You know, in the relative world, this is what's happening. Somebody's attacking and this is what it feels like. It feels like, whew, okay, this is what shame feels like. This is what being scared feels like. This is what being not just blamed but criticized in a kind of a hostile, violent way feels like. Is our capacity to be aware of what's going on in the mind strong enough to bear with that? Because that's what's happening. It's not like you're denying it, you're not avoiding it. The challenge is, can we open to that? And that's what having a strong mind means. Not being willfully strong, willful mind, but just having the strength of mind. And that means the strength of awareness. Is your awareness strong enough, stable enough, flexible, pliable, adaptable enough to open to this kind of experience. And for most of us, it is not. It's not. You know, we have lots of room for improvement. It's very difficult to accept, to acknowledge that we get blamed. Sometimes justifiably, oftentimes not. But blaming, being blamed for someone else's distress or someone else's pain is really hard to feel that, to open to that, feel that. And not just to be defensive and reactive, but to know for yourself what the nature of blame feels like or being blamed feels like. Now, why do I say not to not to get caught in a reactivity or not to, not that it's justified or unjustified, but these things happen to us. We do get blamed. And if we just kind of say, oh, that's your shit. You know, what's it got to do with me? That's your mind, which may be true. You know, they may be way off base. Someone may be way off base in blaming you. But nevertheless, we get to feel the feeling. And is our mind strong enough? Is our awareness of what we're feeling strong enough to bear with the unpleasantness of being blamed? Because it's unpleasant. It feels really unpleasant physically and mentally, emotionally. So when she says, I tried so hard to be strong, that's good. But then I broke out in tears a few times, and of course that made me feel like a failure. That's not true. I mean, to cry or to be, you know, brought to the point of tears or to be humiliated in that way, it happens. Tears are appropriate. You know, it's not a sign of weakness or failure. It's a sign of being in touch with yourself. I kept saying to myself, you just came back from an 8-day retreat. You should be better than this. Why are you so weak? Well, actually, when you go on a retreat, you know, you become very open, very sensitive. You're even more sensitive to the impact of unwise speech than you might have been before the retreat. So you feel things a lot more intensely. And it's not, you know, mindfulness is not about, I should be better than this, so much as it's about, you know, we learn a tool of mindfulness. We learn the tool of wisdom. We learn the tools of how to calm down the mind. We learn the tools of right speech or careful speech, you know. But let's face it, we haven't perfected it yet. You know, we see it as a possibility. We may have it as an aspiration. We may be working on it diligently. But there's always room for improvement. That doesn't mean that you're a failure. It just means that there's, you know, an accurate appraisal of the present moment is, well, not there yet. So I think that just for all of us, if you have an aspiration that exceeds your current capacity, that's not a failure. Just because you can see the possibility or you're striving for, you're practicing for the possibility of more equanimity, more understanding, more responsivity rather than reactivity, but you're not there yet, that's not a failure. That's just clear appraisal of, okay, I'm headed in the right direction, and there's room for improvement. Rather than seeing it as a failure, we can take it as, okay, it's a reminder. Yeah, it's a reminder. It's an acknowledgement of what we find of value. Yeah. Why are you so weak? Because she felt what she felt. And I wouldn't call that weak at all. The fact that she could open to, or, you know, because it was pretty intense, so that she could feel and she could recognize how she was feeling was really a sign of strength in her mind. But she says, I was mad at myself. I would have to caution her not to be mad, but rather just to be realistic and say, yeah, this is normal. This is okay. It's normal. But she knew, I'm only human. That's important. You know, we should always remember that what we're feeling, whether it's painful or pleasant or whatever it is, this is normal. This is normal. Even if it's scary, even if it's shameful, whatever it is, whatever you experience is normal. There's nothing that you ever experience that is not normal. Now, what does that mean, normal? Normal, you know, means, well, it's pretty common, and it arises due to causes and conditions that are mostly outside of your control. It's natural. It's a natural feeling to have in this circumstance or in this situation. So I think we need to recognize that a lot of our conditioning, our family conditioning, our cultural conditioning, our gender conditioning, our age conditioning, our class conditioning, our education conditioning, puts down these markers in our mind of this is okay, this is not okay. You know, and we all have this. We all have these distinctions or these differentiations in our conditioning. And somehow it makes us better than or not so good as others. And that's going to be a source of suffering to us. As long as we buy into those artificial distinctions. So when we recognize that this is human, this is a human feeling, all human beings feel this at some time. Whatever you feel, it's not like you're the only person that ever felt that. It's natural. It's normal. And this really opens the door to areas of our life that our conditioning has cut us off from. You know, as we're growing up, you know, mom and dad and others say, no, don't do that. You know, you shouldn't do that. That's not good to do. You know, and you shouldn't act like that. You shouldn't even believe like that. You know, and so we've taken the message in, and we've kind of cut off that section of life, and cut off that section of life, and later we cut off this kind of experience and that kind of experience. And now at this age, you know, two or three, four, five decades down the road, we've lived in this little narrow channel of what is acceptable, and we've cut off from all this rest of humanity that's in our own heart. This practice of awareness is going to open the doors. It's going to expand that the our awareness of the fullness of our humanity. And some of it is going to be in the, you know, let's call it the spiritual direction of, you know, calm and clarity and peace and aspiration and love and compassion and joy and connectivity and wisdom and generosity and all of those very nice human qualities. And some of the expansion into the fullness of our humanity is going to be into the dark side of life too. And it's going to be some fear and some depression and some despair and some hopelessness and some humiliation and shaming, and there's a lot there. You know, and we've all experienced it. We all have experienced it. We just haven't been encouraged, allowed, permitted to acknowledge it as just, oh, this is normal. This is normal. So as we go about our practice of awakening to the fullness of being a human being, this is part of the terrain. You know, you can expect it. You don't have to go looking for it, but don't be surprised by it. And then she had the clear appraisal of that she was hurting, reacting to one parent's really harsh and hateful words that deep down were due to more than my actions. Clearly, when someone has a ballistic reaction like it seems this person had, you can be sure that they are mainlining and mainstreaming something more than just the current situation, but tapping into a deeper pattern or deeper ongoing conditioning that has been either bottled up or held in or has become habituated to being expressed in that way with rage. Then she says, I should send you the letter that I was sent. It's a very sad one. Ooh. I think when I hear her say sad one, I don't think the letter was sad. I think it was sad for her to read about this person. It's just like, wow. This person evidently was caught in some rage and just judgment that was off the charts. And she could feel sad that someone was caught in or being in that kind of space. I could barely read the entire thing. My body started shaking and reacting very negatively to the words. I'm not sure what she means by negatively, but you know, when you get this strong judgment and fear and threatening language coming at you, it's scary. You know, physically scary, emotionally scary, and otherwise. And fear is just like she says, you know, started shaking and just trembling with fear. That's an appropriate response here. It's not like this is not okay. But we don't have permission in a way from ourselves, let alone others in our lives, to feel the intensity of the fear that we feel. So we have to give ourselves that permission. We have to give ourselves the permission to, you know, if this is what's coming up in my mind, this is what I want to be aware of. And we've all faced fearful situations of one sort or another, you know. And we may be numb to it, but we've faced them. Then she says that as I started to feel this, all of this, I knew that I had to forward the email to her team and to the administration, which is really skillful to when we are dealing with intense, anything, you know, that is destabilizing, then to have allies. And your allies can be your team, it can be your partner, it can be your teacher, your Dharma teacher, it can be anybody, but to get some support for kind of normalizing and kind of being able to be affirmed for just having that experience, holding that experience, being able to be in that experience. So then she says, what would you advise me to do? I think she did pretty good, actually. You know, I think she did really good. Trying to be aware. The thing that I got was, while this was going on, she was trying to be aware of her mind. You know, and in this, you don't hear a lot of blaming of the other person. She's not saying blah, 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 blah. She may have felt it, but she's trying to watch her mind's reaction to what was going on. And this is what we're doing with practice, is when stuff goes on, we're trying to know our mind. We're not saying, no, nothing out there is happening. You know, we recognize things are happening, but how it's affecting us is our mind. That's what we have to watch. I said last night, or I mentioned last night, that my current teacher, Utejaniya, has said, the mind is not yours, but you're responsible for it. Meaning, what arises in the mind, you know, in this situation, what arises in this teacher's mind, she doesn't get to say, yeah, I want to feel this, and I don't want to feel that, and I want to think this, and I don't want to think that. It's just not possible. It's just like it's out of control. It's out of her control, what arises in her mind. She can't control the mind. She can't only let in what she wants to let in. The mind is not hers. It is vulnerable to conditioning by everything. But once the conditioning has come together and has provoked this response in her heart, in her mind, then she has to do something with it. She has to be responsible now for this reactivity. Not that she's responsible for reacting, but she has to do something with it. She can either act it out, she can fire off a letter of reactivity to the person who provoked her, she can seek allies, she can try to do her own meditation, whatever. She has to be responsible for caring for the mind that has been provoked in this way. So when we see our mind provoked, it's easy to just go, you know, whack, you know, just kind of push away the provocateur or the provoking conditions of our life and just blame them. Just say, you're the problem. You're my problem. You're the problem of my suffering. But actually, that's only a proximate cause of our suffering. Our suffering is in our heart. It's our reaction to it and our inability to be with, or challenge to be with, the reaction in our own heart. That's the work that we're working. That's the area of our life that we're working on with awareness practice, is to know our own mind in these situations. To know how we're provoked, why we're provoked, what it's like, and can I bear with this provocation? And we're not giving permission to anybody to act out in a harmful way, but we're just recognizing our own responsibility to deal with our own pain, really. I started investigating and asking myself lots of questions about how I was feeling, why I was reacting so aggressively to these words, and the nature of all this. And I think that this is the direction we're going to go. Well, this is the direction we're going to go this afternoon, is when, you know, when the mind is filled with some reactivity of some distressing emotion, whether it's fear or sadness or shame or blame or whatever, rather than push away from it, or push it away, or push ourselves away, or internalizing it into depression and despair and frustration. Rather, the invitation of wisdom and the invitation of mindful insight is to learn about this state of mind. Learn about the nature of fear, in this case, fear. Learn about the nature of being shamed. What is it? What's it actually feel like? How is it that we get shamed into feeling, you know, inadequate? How does that work? You know, we all get it at different times, but how does it work? Why is it that we get hooked by, you know, you read the headlines, you read some headlines, and immediately you have this reaction of anger or rage? Why is that? What is it about our self that has to be so reactive, that has to suffer with the feelings of rage and anger? That's our suffering, right? It's not like anybody else's suffering. When you're angry and rageful, that's your suffering. It's my suffering. I have to do something about that. Nobody else can do something about that. I can't change the world. I can't have everybody in the world have the same views and opinions that I have. What a boring world that would be, you know? And I can't change the world. All I can do is recognize with awareness my own heart and change that. And when we change our reactivity, our conditioned reactivity, by learning about the nature of that reactivity. I don't mean read a book. I mean, when you're caught in anger, really watch your own mind. When you're caught in rage, really watch your own mind. When you're caught in sadness, fear, anything, really watch your own mind. Learn about the nature of these states of mind, how they arise, why they arise, what they feel like, what they make you feel like, and how long they last, and what they do to your sense of self, what they do to your sense of confidence, what they do to your sense of interest in practice, even. These are important things too, that you will learn as you are interested in learning about these suffering states of mind. So what I'm doing is preparing, laying out the views, the right views, the Dharma views of how to treat, how to understand emotional distress. Because we have it. We get it, right? We've all been emotionally distressed a lot. You know, and we still get caught. We still get caught in you know, being depressed, being fearful, being enraged. Why? Well, because we do not yet understand the nature of these states of mind. Saito Tejaniya, the current monk that I've been practicing with for the last decade or so, he says, it's not you who gets rid of this emotional distress. Wisdom does that work. Meaning, it's understanding that is going to free our heart from the suffering of this emotional distress. It's not going to stop the emotion. They're going to arise. But when we are entangled in it in an ongoing way and really suffering, It's if we could say to our mind, mind, be happy, don't be sad. And by the way, don't be afraid or depressed either. If we could say that to our mind, we all would have said it and we'd be done with it, right? But you can say it. It doesn't work, does it? You can't tell your mind what to do. Your mind won't listen to you. So clearly, you cannot get rid of those states of mind. You can distract yourself from them. You can kind of act them out and get rid of them. You can kind of minimize them or ignore them. But still, they're there. They're just festering under the surface, aren't they? So what is it that's going to actually temper their appearance in your heart? And how are we ever going to be free of them? This is through the development of wisdom. The self-knowledge that knows this is the very nature of fear. This is the very nature of shame. This is the very nature of humiliation. This is the very nature of depression. And we can learn. We can learn. It's not like some people are just not depressed and some people are. No. Any of us can learn about these states of mind. You know, as I think it was Manindra said to Joseph. Manindra's a teacher in India from some years ago, and Joseph Goldstein. He says, if you want to understand your mind, if you want to understand your heart, just sit down and look. That's where you find out. Unfortunately, the best you can get from a book is somebody else's understanding. And for you, it's not liberating. It's interesting. It maybe shows you the direction to go, but you still have to do your own work. And this is what insight practice is. That's why we practice like we did this morning, just learning how to be present with the most benign experiences of our life. Breathing. Hello. Breathing in, breathing out. Can I be aware of that with some continuity? Well, evidently not too good yet. We're working on it. But what happens is, as we train in being present with the most simple, normal, ordinary, mundane, recurring, habitual things, breathing, stepping, looking, reaching for doorknobs, putting on your shoes, we train the mind to be aware of simple things like that, non-threatening, so that we get a momentum, we get a continuity to the awareness, so that when the mind is provoked to a suffering state of mind, then the mindfulness is already there to be there and recognize it. Then you can observe it. Then you can be with, because you have the strength of mind. You've been training the mind with non-threatening experiences, so that when a threatening experience arises, your mind is ready for it. The mind has the strength to kind of say, wow, breathing in, breathing out, raging. Wow, raging. Wow, that's, ooh. That's what rage is like, huh? Okay. And as we learn about it, we will not only learn its nature, we understand why it arises, how it arises, what are the conditions that give rise to rage in your mind? What are the conditions that give rise to depression in your mind? What are the conditions that give rise to feeling guilty in your mind? Because you'll see that these conditions that come together to provoke a reaction of distress in you, in your heart, these conditions you don't control. You can't make you never know when they're going to happen. We never know when somebody's going to say something, do something, when conditions are going to happen, and we just get provoked, do we? If we could, to the extent that we do know, we avoid those situations. That's wisdom. But sometimes we just get blindsided and stuff happens. So to have some contingency plans for these inevitable conditions, we practice awareness. We practice awareness just like we've been doing this morning, and in order to strengthen the mind for when provoked into one of these distressing states of mind, so that we can see, we can be with, we can learn from, and we don't have to be so caught up in, entangled in, defensive about, acting it out blindly, all of which causes more suffering to us and others. This is the way that mindfulness, leading to insightful understanding of our experience, leads to freedom from suffering. Did you follow that? That's how it works. It's not magic. It's not hocus pocus. When I was first practicing with, Upandita, again, I'd been practicing already for, let's see, that was in 84. First practicing in 84. I'd been practicing for 9 years already, doing retreats. For 9 years already, and I was just practicing with him. So one time, I don't know what I was reporting to him when I, in one of my daily reports. I was reporting something, and he looks at me and he said, well, what do you think we're doing here? What do you think this process is? And I said, well, I thought you just sit down, you know, and you try to be mindful, and then poof, one day you're enlightened. And he just burst out laughing. He just laughed, and he just said, well, that's the most ridiculous thing he ever heard. You know, he didn't say it like that, but it was that his demeanor was that's what he was saying. And then, you know, he went on to explain, and I've since come to understand that you don't just sit down and poof anything. You sit down and you work hard at understanding your own conditioning, letting go of that, and opening to the fullness of human life and non-reactivity. And the way that we get to the place of non-reactivity or balanced mind, equanimity. Equanimity, by the way, is the 10th of the contingency plans on the handout that I put up there. Equanimity. How is it that we get to equanimity where when provoked, when the conditions in life are provocative, and when we would normally get caught in sadness or rage or fear or desire, this just insatiable desire that you cannot satisfy, that we have an equanimous mind. We have a balanced mind. We can see, oh, this is what's going on. We understand, oh, this is what's going on. I'm being provoked into, you know, this kind of obsessive, compulsive, addictive demand and need for satisfying my desire. And we've all felt that. Whew. So you can see it's not just a matter of staying with the breath so you don't feel things, so you don't wake up to this, you don't even know what's going on, you're just staying with the breath. That's good. That gives you a temporary calmness. If you're really good at staying with the breath, you can really stay chilled. But still, you're going to get blindsided in life. Sometimes you're not going to be paying attention to the breath, and conditions are going to come together, and you're going to get provoked into reactivity. That's what the Buddha said. You know, you can be a good person. Be careful how you speak. Be careful how you act. Don't hurt anybody with what you say and do. That's good. That'll take care of a lot of suffering in your life. Actually, if you look at the news, and on any day, you look at the news is a catalog of suffering by people not keeping the precepts. That's what it is. The daily catalog of suffering from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, use of intoxicants, and not telling the truth. I challenge you to, I've done this, taken a whole magazine and read every article and just identified what precept wasn't being kept. Do that. It's really fascinating, and you'll see. Every article is people not keeping the precepts and the tremendous suffering that's causing. Nevertheless, just acting and speaking carefully doesn't stop you from obsessing. You know, we obsess. We obsess with wanting to say what we want to say, but don't. Wanting to do what we don't do because it's illegal or shameful or whatever. And, you know, and so we can get caught in obsessing. And that this is equally a painful, suffering state of mind. When you're obsessed with getting something or, you know, doing something or caught in some rage, obsessive state of mind, suffering. You know, and that's where mindfulness is really the tool. Because if you can learn to just stay attentive to one thing other than what's enraging you, you can calm down. That's what mindfulness is for. You know, just calm down in the face of provocative conditions that you don't control. And so Mindfulness is the antidote to obsessing of all kinds. Just being aware of either a primary object, like the breath we used this morning, or even being aware of whatever else arises in your mind, moment to moment. If you can do that, you also won't be caught in it. Being aware of anger, let me just say, being angry, thinking about your anger, and being aware that anger has arisen in your mind are three very, very different experiences. But they all happen when anger is in the mind. So when anger arises in the mind, we can do one of three things. We can either be angry, think about it, obsess about it, or we can be aware of it. Very different experiences. So even though mindfulness itself is sufficient for cutting off obsessing, it's not of itself sufficient for understanding what is causing the provocation. Mindfulness alone is not enough. We need right view, we need wisdom, we need faith, we need a lot of other supports in order to understand the nature of suffering. Mindfulness can cut it off, boom, no problem. But as I said, you know, you may not be able to be with the breath. You may not be able to recognize the present moment all the time. And then we're vulnerable again to being provoked into reactivity. So it's only when we not only purify our speech and behavior, which gives us some tranquility in our life, some harmony living with others, and it's not only being mindful and purifying your mind in the moment of obsessing, which gives us a sense of tranquility, but it's purifying our understanding. When we purify our understanding through insight, through our own personal empirical experience of the way things are in our own heart, how we get caught, that's where we begin to loosen the grip of conditioning, the conditioning that we've acquired from parents and peers and governments and all kinds of things. That is the wrong view that doesn't lead to the end of suffering. It leads to more suffering. And we only know this from ourselves because we've watched our own heart. We're sensitive to our own heart. What causes suffering? And what causes the end of suffering? You can't read this in a book. It's not in one of those magazines at the checkout counter at the grocery store. It's not there. Believe me. If it's there, it's not real. And it won't do you any good anyway. You can only read the book of your own heart to understand the causes of your suffering and the end of your suffering. That's why we practice mindfulness. That's why we practice mindfulness in order to calm down, mindfulness in order to speak and act carefully, but mindful awareness with wisdom, with faith, with energy, with stability of mind, in order to understand things the way they are. Because when we understand things the way they are, and we live in alignment with the way things are, then we stop struggling. We stop struggling, we stop being in friction with the way things are, we stop living a dissonant life, and we start living in alignment with nature. The nature of the body, the nature of the mind, the nature of human interaction, the nature of the whole mishigosh that's going on in our hearts and mind. And then when we learn to live in alignment with that, well, if you're living in alignment with the way things are, there's no suffering. There's no struggle. It's just, this is the way it is. That's when equanimity really becomes, you know, you really understand the value of having a balanced and a non-reactive mind. That's why we practice. You know, we're not sitting here just to kind of avoid the weather. You know, right? There's something good that can come out of our practice here. So this is the a brief overview of the Buddha's teaching and a support for what we're going to do this afternoon, which is open our attention even further, not just to the fullness of the breath and everything else that's coming up in the mind, but to begin to observe the mind that's doing this work, Okay.